Okay, so we're moving on now to Harriet Freke, The Life and Death Thereof by Mae Sinclair. A short but deceptively deep volume, I think, because last time we met, we were mentioning this, that you could probably sit down and read the whole novel in maybe, you know, 1.5, 2 hours, something like that. In this older edition that I have here, it's 180 pages of very large print. So, you know, it's actually very easy to read in that sense. But the issues that it raises and the techniques that it uses are obviously of interest to us looking at modernism. So, although it's short and, you know, relatively straightforward in terms of its structure, I think there's an awful lot that we can get out of this, and it does go to the heart of a lot of the themes of modernism. So, today I want to say something about Mae Sinclair as a modernist and say a little bit about her career. And in particular, say something about her interest in psychoanalysis. We've not explored this too much so far, but clearly it's a key element of a lot of modernist practice. Psychoanalysis is a new set of theories at the beginning of the 20th century, and Sinclair had a particularly developed interest in that. And I want to finish by saying something about narrative technique in Harriet Freke. So we're going to speak in general terms about Mae Sinclair, look at this idea of psychoanalysis as it's applied to this text, and say a little bit about narrative technique, and then next week we'll move into looking in more detail at particular elements that are contained within the novel. One thing that, one kind of very minor thing that but is worth pointing out and emphasising lots of times, I think, is that Harriet has two T's. Right? Harriet has two T's. There are several potential spelling mistakes in modernism, and this is the first one we've encountered, really. Harriet, and it's an unusual spelling of Harriet, isn't it? You would expect it to have one T, but it's got two. So, hanging offence if you spell it with one. And we will explore how you spell four marks for T.S. Eliot when the time comes. Right, so, moving on. First of all, thinking about Mae Sinclair as a person, she is, like so many of our modernists, a Victorian. She's born not far from here in Rock Ferry in 1863. And I thought not 1862 or 65 there, because you'll find some reference works that do give those dates, but it's actually 1863. So she's born at the peak of the Victorian expansion, of Victorian power, so she's very much in the middle of that kind of Victorian era. So you think there's a young woman in her 20s, say, she's living in a world where Britain is the industrial centre of the world, where the empire stretches all over the world. She's very much a product of the Victorian age. But of course, when you get to look at Harriet Freke, although it's published in 1922, it deals with somebody who was born a bit later than she was, but you know, roughly the same kind of era. Like many Victorian women, she didn't have much of an education. Her brothers did. She had, I think, a year at Cheltenham Ladies' College, which, of course, is a sort of posh public school. I think Madonna sent her kid there. So it must be good, obviously. Cheltenham Ladies' College for a limited time, but most of the time spent at home. And there are lots of parallels between Mae Sinclair's life and the life of Harriet Freke. In particular, I think, this business of the father. The father is somebody who works originally in Liverpool, in the ports. He's a businessman, but he's not a very good businessman. And there are all kinds of problems. So they live, the Sinclair family, before the father dies, they live in sort of genteel poverty. And then she spends a lot of her early life looking after her mother. And the mother doesn't die until the turn of the century. So by that stage, May Sinclair is in her late 30s. Okay, so her career doesn't really start until that point. So it's fairly late. She's a fairly late developer in terms of how she gets on in her writing career. She has written a little bit before then, before her mother's death, but the death of her mother seems to release her, and she then starts a very prolific writing career. And in the Edwardian period, in the first 10 years of the 20th century, May Sinclair establishes herself as a popular novelist, and there's a point in the early years of the 20th century where she's actually a very popular novelist, writing sort of quite racy fiction about marriage, largely, and the problems of marriage. And that's unusual, I think, in our modernist canon, you know, that you've got somebody who is actually quite well-known and quite a popular writer. And her more experimental fiction doesn't really come until a bit later. And there are two books, really, that kind of define May Sinclair's life and career. And one of them is Harriet Freeman, which is the one that we're looking at. And the other one is Mary Olivier. Mary Olivier, written around about the same time as Harriet Freeman, is another kind of life-of type story. And the central character, Mary Olivier, is a writer. And the parallels between May Sinclair's life and Mary Olivier's life are fairly clear for everybody to see. But interestingly, I think, with Mary Olivier, what you get is somebody who manages to channel her energy, the energy that's kind of pent up and unable to be released because of the way that women's position in society is. All that pent up energy is released into writing. And one of the features, I think, of Harriet Freeman, as we'll see as we go through that, is that she has no outlet for those energies. And so she just kind of atrophies. Her life is a chronicle of unfulfillment. So May Sinclair then has this rather unusual career trajectory, shall we say. She's writing novels, as I say, just before her mother dies, from 1896 onwards. So she's in her 30s before she gets going as a writer. And as I say, she's crossing that popular literary divide with these novels largely on marriage problems. However, and we've seen this, haven't we, several times, how the kind of social circles are influential in modernism. And she is one of these people who pops up all over the place. She knew Ezra Pound, she knew Ford, everybody knew Ford, it appears. Richard Aldington and HD, she knew those, the Imagists. So she's got a toe in various circles, and becomes, you know, a well-known figure amongst those modernists. And one of the things in which she's influential is in her reviews, so because she's a critical writer as well as a creative writer. So she writes about the Imagist poets, and we mentioned her review of the Imagist poets when we were looking at those. And she also writes about Dorothy Richardson. Now, Dorothy Richardson is somebody who we don't have time really to look at on our course, but she is an influential writer. And labour this point a little bit, because Dorothy Richardson wrote a sequence of novels, beginning with one called Pointed Roofs. And this was largely a kind of autobiographical sequence that goes on for, I think, 13 volumes in the end. And that's really her life's work. And in a review of Dorothy Richardson's first volume, May Sinclair used the term stream of consciousness. And that was the first time that that phrase had been used in a literary sense. Dorothy Richardson actually didn't like it, but nonetheless, the term stuck. So the idea of a literary technique which sets out to put onto the page the you know that Virginia Woolf idea of the teeming atoms as they enter the brain, calling that stream of consciousness was actually May Sinclair's idea. She didn't coin the phrase. The phrase was coined by William James, who's the brother of Henry James. And he wrote, he's largely interested in psychology, and he wrote a book in the 1890s in which he used the term stream of consciousness to describe, you know, what happens to your head on a daily basis, you know, the stream of thoughts that go through your head. So May Sinclair is the first one to use that as a literary term, if you like. So she's an interesting figure in terms of her writing, obviously, but in terms of her influence on the way in which we think about modernist texts, and in her connections too. And we'll just sketch a few more of that in as we go along now. So, having become a kind of popular writer of fiction in the Edwardian era, in her modernist phase, she becomes more experimental. And I think one very key moment is when she gets very interested in something called the Medico-Psychological Clinic of London. And this is set up in Bloomsbury, where else, in 1913. And it's set up to develop the work of Freud, particularly, and Jung. And it's the first kind of psychoanalytical facility, if we can call it that, in the United Kingdom. So she's there at the kind of cutting edge of this particular development. And she helps it by donating money to it, because she's fairly well off by this stage, having had a successful popular career as a writer. And she also actually works there as well. So it's particularly appropriate, I suppose, that in her novels she obviously uses these kinds of insights, particularly Freudian and Jungian ideas, to delineate character, and that's what we'll see, I think, in Harriet Freeman. So she develops this interest in psychology and psychoanalysis. She writes the first review of Jung's Psychology of the Unconscious, which was published originally in 1912 in German. And so it's interesting that in these years, you know, she's heavily involved in that sort of idea, exploration of that kind, that area of knowledge. And the result, really, is that she produces Mary Olivier in 1919, and then 1922, Harriet Freeman. So you can see these novels almost as a kind of product of her interest in psychoanalysis. And particularly the way in which she uses symbolism. So, in Harriet Freeman, for example, as I'm sure you've noticed, there's a repetition of particular motifs and particular symbols that for the reader, you know, become almost on a page by page basis. You've got these kind of extensively repeated ideas which obviously then gain resonance by repetition. And I'm thinking particularly of the strange blue egg, which is at the centerpiece of the living room when she's a child and which she carries through her life. And the red campion flowers, which crop up at various points in the story, very significant points in the story. And there are other symbols and motifs as well. So this is writing which depends to quite a lot, quite a large extent, on interpretation of symbolic patterns. And that's one of the complicating elements, I think, in the story, because on the face of it, what you have is a very straightforward story. It's chronological, life and death of Harriet Green. You go through her life, in a chronological sequence. So you'd think that's actually quite a straightforward thing. But one of the complicating factors, as I say, is the heavy use of symbolism, which adds this complex psychological layer to the story. And so what you have really is an examination of selfhood, the identity of the central character, through the exploration of her psyche. So if you remember, we talked a bit ago about the modernist emphasis on the internal rather than the external, then here's a great example of that, I think, this whole novel, because in terms of what happens in the novel, there are very few major incidents, or perhaps rather, there are very few overtly, explicitly described major incidents in a long life. We travel with Harriet Green literally from cradle to grave. So in this long life, there appear to be hardly any sort of major incidents. But what we do get is the development or the non-development of her mind and her psyche. And we then begin to examine things which might not look that significant and begin to see perhaps some significance in them. So there's a lot of delving to do as a reader. I think you have to be an active reader with Harriet Freeman, because on the face of it, if you just kind of read it passively, then what you have is this uneventful life, which ends in death on the final pages, and a shrug of the shoulders. Well, so what? But actually, I think there's this seething mass of stuff going on underneath the surface, and that's what we have to access, I think. Okay. Some more modernist elements that we can tease out in this novel. I mean, the first thing to say is that it is self-consciously experimental in terms of its compression. One of the things that you might expect from a novel called The Life and Death of Somebody is that it's going to be a bit like those 18th century novels. The Life and Strange Surprising Adventures of Robinson Crusoe. The Life and Adventures of Tom Jones. The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy. Those sorts of novels where you have a named person who is a central focus, and you do go right the way through their lives. One of the obvious things to say about those novels by Defoe and Fielding and so on is that they're very long, aren't they? They're hundreds of pages long. This is very short. So you're getting the whole life, quite a long life, you're getting the whole life in a very compressed package. Compare and contrast Ulysses, where you've got 500 pages to cover one day, and here you've got, as I say, 180 very large print pages to cover however old she is when she dies, 70-something. So that's part of the experimental style of this, I think, that very strong compression of events. And sometimes one of the things that you will recognise, I think, as you read it, is that the compression, the treatment of time is drawn attention to, so that you have phrases such as several years passed, and you know, no comment on that. But you know, several years have passed. You know, did nothing happen in those years? Apparently not. So you know, you are often being reminded of the way in which the novelist treats time. The narrative style, as I say, she's the first to use the term stream of consciousness, and there are some examples of stream of consciousness or something that's very akin to stream of consciousness in this novel. And one of the things we'll do in seminars is try to identify some of those passages. But most of the time, there's an omniscient third-person narrative. So you have an external narrator who knows everything, knows the intimate thoughts of the characters, or knows the intimate thoughts of one character, Harriet Freeman. But very often, you get the interweaving of her thoughts into that narrative commentary. So in a way that we'll see again with Virginia Woolf, what happens is that you move from an apparently external narrative into something which is a bit more complex, something which is representing something like the consciousness of the character without any intervening she thoughts that occurred to her, those sorts of things. So you have to be alert, I think, for those things as you come across them. It isn't as straightforward as you might think. So what that means is that the idea of objectivity becomes an issue. Mostly, the obvious advantage of an omniscient third-person narrator is that you have what you might call an objective view. That third-person narrator knows everything, so can set out, you know, the truth, if we want to use that term, of the story. Once you kind of draw back from that and you start to interweave the thoughts of the character, well, you know, you're then losing that objectivity and it becomes more subjective. When we come to The Good Soldier, you might find a productive comparison there. Dowell in The Good Soldier is a first-person narrator, and so therefore, from the start, we might think he's not entirely reliable. And as we progress through The Good Soldier, very quickly we come to the conclusion that he's actually highly unreliable narrator. And in terms of Harriet Freeman, the interweaving of Harriet's thoughts with the external narrator's thoughts sets up a kind of tension, so that we as a reader are being led to interpret what the reality is as opposed to what Harriet might think the reality is. And it's put very well, I think, by Penny Brown in her book Poison at the Source. The pervading irony of the disparity between the way things really are and the way Harriet perceives them. And so there's this interpretative function that we have to carry out as a reader, whereby we're presented with some information which Harriet interprets in one way, and we are then obliged to interpret it in another way. And this is one of the ways that I think in which the symbolism works, that we perhaps see and read more into the symbols than Harriet does. Or Harriet does certainly at a conscious level. I think it's clear that unconsciously, you know, there's an awful lot going on in Harriet's mind. So one of the ways in which the novel works, I think, is to focus very, very closely on Harriet's thought processes, so that although you have largely a third-person narrator, you're not allowed to sort of go beyond Harriet's world at all. And it's only very, very rarely, and I think perhaps only in one case, where we kind of break free from that, and Harriet manages to break free and see the world as we might see it. And this is the passage that I mean. This is from fairly late on, where, if you recall, she's been visited by the niece of the man that she probably should have married, and she's been given a story by this niece which parallels her own. The niece has had pretty much, and it's actually a rather clunky narrative device, the niece has had pretty much exactly the same choice to make as Harriet did all those years ago when Robin declared her love to her. Harriet, because she wants to behave beautifully to please her parents, turns down Robin and potentially turns down the chance of happiness. The niece, of course, does the opposite, and Harriet sees that as selfish, and the niece sees it as just fulfilling her desires and becoming happy. And this is how it's presented to us at that point in the novel. She saw the girl, Robin's niece, in her young indignation, her tender brilliance, suddenly hard, suddenly cruel, flashing out the truth. The truth. Now that's important, I think. She's for the first time, possibly for the only time in the novel, she's asking herself questions about her own self-image, about her own belief, about her own worldview. Was it true that she had sacrificed Robin and Priscilla and Beatrice to her parents' idea of moral beauty? Was it true that this idea, I mean, these are kind of rhetorical questions, because we as a reader are saying, yes, it damn well was, yes, you've got it wrong. That she might have married Robin and been happy and been right. Yes, yes, that's right, Harriet. Yeah, you know, that's where you weren't completely wrong. What does she say after that, though? She says, well, does she say it? It's in inverted commas. It's probably just a thought, isn't it? I don't care. If it was to be done again tomorrow, I'd do it. So even though she's beginning to see how that particular choice in her life, the major point of her life, the fulcrum on which her whole life depends, even though she's beginning to realise that she's got that completely wrong, and the truth has been illuminated for her by the visit of this rather awkward niece. And as I say, it's a very, very kind of awkward narrative device. She's still in denial. I don't care. If it was to be done again tomorrow, I'd do it. But the beauty of that unique act, that word beauty again comes up over and over again, behaving beautifully. The beauty of that unique act no longer appeared to her as it once was, uplifting, consoling, incorruptible. So here's a good illustration of the way in which she works as in kind of self-denial all the way through. So even for one time in her life, when she gets an insight into how she really is, she still puts it to one side and says, no, I'd do it all again. You know, what I did was actually right, even though vaguely I'm groping towards a realisation that actually it was wrong. And it's spoilt the beauty of that for her now forever. It no longer appeared to her as it once was. But even so, she's still denying it. So that's an exception in the sense that for most of the novel, she won't actually admit that. She won't actually admit that anything she did was wrong. She's always made the right choice. She's always done the right thing. She's always behaved beautifully. And that's at one point where she has this doubt. But even then, even though she realises that she was wrong, those questions that she asked in that first paragraph, even though she realises she's wrong, she puts that to one side and says to herself, if it was to be done again tomorrow, I'd do it. So she would, you know, she would not actually change anything. So that's an exception. Most of the time, though, we get free and direct speech where her thoughts are presented to us in this form. And you can see how, what I was saying before, how this changes within the paragraph. So this is when she's talking to Robin, who's come to see her after years and years, and he's sort of invalided now. So she's talking to him, "My dear, your nurse had nothing else to do. Your wife has to clean and mend for you and cook your dinner and mow the lawn and nail the carpets down." He's nailed the carpets down because he's wheelchair bound. So that's obviously directly reported speech. And then the next line, while she said it, she looked at Robin as if she adored him. So that's an external narrator, isn't it, telling us that. The next sentence, all through tea time he talked about his health and about the sanitary dustbin they hadn't got. Still the external narrator. But then, something had happened to him. It wasn't like him to be wrapped up in himself and to talk about dustbins. So we're now in Harriet Freeman's mind, aren't we? He spoke to his wife as if she had been his valet. He didn't see that she was perspiring, worn out by her struggle with the carpet. And then we're moving back towards a third-person narrator. So you get this kind of very loose organisation of thought patterns. And I think as a reader, you have to be aware that you often are going to move from what is apparently an external narrator into something that's much more like free and direct. So that bit in the middle, something had happened to him, it wasn't like him to be wrapped up in himself. Those are quite clearly her thoughts, aren't they? But there isn't an external narrator saying, it seemed to her that, she thought that. So we have to kind of tune in to that as it happens. And that's one of the ways, I think, in which Mason Clare adopts this kind of very typical modernist approach to the way in which thoughts are presented. She uses that free and direct style a lot. We have got an external narrator, of course. And here's here's a good example of it. This is about halfway through. This is when her mother dies. In all her previsions of the event, she had seen herself surviving as the same Harriet Freeman with the addition of an overwhelming grief. And one of the interesting things, again, about the way in which her character is presented is that it's often about this idea of her identity. So here's a traumatic event in her life, the death of the mother. Traumatic event. And her response is all about how she is going to be presented to the world. You know, it's not kind of looking back, it's not reminiscing, it's about how she is going to be. She had seen herself, in her previsions of the event, she had seen herself as the same Harriet Freeman. She was horrified at this image of herself persisting beside her mother's place, empty in space and time. She was not there. It's interesting, ambiguous there, isn't it? She was not there. Who was not there? Is that the mother, or is it Harriet Freeman? The mother is not there, clearly, because she's died. But it's, you know, it's not entirely clear, and that could be sort of metaphorical, couldn't it? Through her absorption in her mother, some large essential part of herself had gone. It had not been so when her father died. What he had absorbed was given back to her, transferred to her mother. All her memories of her mother were joined to the memory of this now irrecoverable self. This now irrecoverable self. So this idea of Harriet Freeman's lack of identity is absolutely nailed there by the external narrator, because she has subsumed her identity within that of her parents. And once her father dies, it's all transferred to her mother, and now her mother has died. So what? What's she got left? She hasn't got anything. This now irrecoverable self. And she doesn't, you know, it's irrecoverable in the sense that she can't get it back. But it's also irrecoverable in the sense that she can't recover from it. She can't recover from this event because she has invested everything, literally everything, into subsuming her identity into her mother's. And now her mother's gone, so what can she do? So a lot of the second half of the novel seems to focus on this idea of the empty shell that Harriet Freeman has become, if she wasn't that already. She becomes this kind of husk of a person. You know, she doesn't have any kind of presence, and that's why in the passage that we just looked at, when she gets this unexpected visit, you know, she's shocked into a realization of what she might have been, what she has become, what she might have become, and the realization that she puts to one side, that she could have been happy, she could have made a decision that would have worked for her. Stream of consciousness we mentioned, and I think what's clear is that you don't get stream of consciousness in Harriet Freeman in the way that you do in James Joyce. But what you do get are some points where the free and direct style drifts into a kind of stream of consciousness technique. So here, right at the end, she's delirious at this point. She's on her deathbed, and she's going back in her mind. Of course, there is that kind of circular movement in the novel, from the girl in the cradle at the beginning, and the nursery rhyme that she remembers, the pussycat, where have you been, that one. And she's regressing to her childhood in her deathbed at the end. And interestingly, at the point of death, she starts thinking about babies. And she thinks about Maggie's baby, that she has certain responsibility for. And she associates that with the strange lane at the back of their house when she was a girl, about which, you know, there is a mysterious thing that goes on there, and we don't quite know what it is. And again, that's one of the things that you have to delve into the narrative to find out about. And she's associating those two things, and then she's eliding that with the nursery rhyme that she remembers from her very young childhood. But what you can see there is consciousness that's flitting from one idea to another, and the grammar and the punctuation doesn't quite break down. But you can see how the association works, can't you? Pussycat, pussycat, pussy, prissy, prissycat, poor prissy, this is Priscilla, who married Robin. So she's, you know, you can see how those connections work, and you can see how that might happen in somebody who's drifting off to death in a state of delirium, drugged up with whatever she's got in that hospital. You don't get much more than that in terms of stream of consciousness in Harriet Freeman. It's a novel which is quite clearly consciously experimental, but not that experimental. So one of the things I think when we come to look at it in more detail is to look at how the psychoanalytical insights drive the novel. And lead to some of the interesting choices that Mason Clare makes in terms of the narrative. But in terms of experimentation on the page, as it were, there isn't that much. And this is you know, one of the few occasions where you do get syntax breaking down a bit, and you do get that kind of direct access to the character's mind. So the novel, I think, then, is one that is challenging. And part of the reason that it's challenging is that it doesn't appear to be that challenging. You know, I think if you pick up this kind of short novel, almost a novella length, really, it is a kind of odd length for a novel. And you think, oh, well, it's a brief account of this person's life. Which on one level, of course, it is, but on so many other levels, it works in a much deeper way. And I think, you know, that's our task, really, is to unravel some of those depths and get to grips with that. Okay, so next week we are going to look in more detail at some particular passages and trying to tease out a bit more of the psychoanalytical elements of this. I'm finishing slightly early, I don't know why, but there we go. So you have a longer break than normal.